It's Patricia Karpus, host of Untangle, the award-winning podcast that covers topics like optimizing brain health, finding your purpose, how to sleep better, harnessing the power of anxiety, successfully changing habits, finding more happiness and joy, and overall, all the many ways to live your best life. If you enjoy hearing from thought leaders, neuroscientists, psychologists, nutritionists, business leaders, and more, join us wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, everyone. I wanted to replay this episode of David Posis, The Weight of Air. Unfortunately, David passed away this week. And to honor his life and his legacy, I thought it would be a good idea to replay his interview. He was a tireless advocate for all who struggled with mental health or addiction issues, and that was much of his life's work. My heart goes out to all of his family and friends. David, thank you so much for your work. And if you would like to support his family at this time, there is a GoFundMe campaign. Go to GoFundMe and type in David Posis. I'll also put a link on theaddictedmind.com as well. Let's go ahead and play his episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Addicted Mind podcast. My guest today is David Posis, and he is going to talk about his book, The Weight of Air, and he's going to talk about his own recovery story. David, why don't you just start by introducing yourself?
Hi, I'm David Posis. I guess I'm a writer. I do speaking gigs, activism whenever possible, just trying to spread truth and cut through the noise.
Awesome. Great. So let's just jump in. Let's start talking about your story of addiction and how it manifested. One of the things I also want to talk about, because I know your story talks about depression and mental health as well as addiction. So I want to get there too, but I just want to kind of hear it from the beginning.
Okay, sure. I guess I was, long before depression entered my vocabulary, I was depressed. I was a sad kid. My mom used to ask, why are you so sad all the time? I knew that I didn't want to be sad, but I didn't know how to not be sad. So in the early childhood drug prevention programs, we had I grew up in the 80s. So it was the DARE program. This cop came to my school in fifth grade. He told us why you shouldn't drink and smoke pot and cocaine and basically everything. And he said heroin was the worst drug. And he said it makes you not have any feelings. It's a painkiller so powerful that you don't have any feelings. And I thought, like, that sounds like exactly what I need.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So he didn't say it in a good way, obviously. But that sounded perfect. So I grew up in Westchester County in New York, and heroin in the early 90s, there wasn't an opioid crisis. So heroin was just this hardcore drug that nobody went near. And all my friends, starting in, eighth, ninth grade, everybody was drinking and smoking pot. And I tried alcohol and weed, and I couldn't stand them. I hated the feeling. I got drunk once, and it was really just horrifying. And, but heroin was impossible to find. So I guess to make a long story short, I tracked it down finally just before 10th grade started. And it was exactly what I had hoped it would be. And at that point, I'd been in therapy since I was about 4 or 5 years old, and three different psychiatrists decided that I was depressed. They tried, every conceivable antidepressant on the market at the time. Nothing helped, and heroin was the only thing that was effective. And I had reached. Sorry, yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, can you talk a little bit about that depression and what's that like? I have a similar story because for me, I went into rehab when I was 17, and a big chunk of it was really depression. And I think some people, it's hard if you haven't struggled with depression, it's hard to understand that pain, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess, I thought of it as, I was hurting, and it was really so frustrating because, like you sprain your ankle And it's all kind of sympathy. And we know that, you know, you're not going to be able to will that pain away or snap out of it. You know, you go to the hospital and you get the crutches and whatever. With emotional pain, you know, people tell you, you know, calm down, snap out of it. Don't you want to be happy? That doesn't matter. I mean, that kind of stuff just made me feel so much worse. And
it puts more blame on you. Like, you shouldn't have this pain. Like, just get over it.
Exactly. And, you know, it was really like, I couldn't find a place that felt good because the guilt of the depression was so intense. And so, you know, I mean, you know, pain is the only subjective vital sign. And I think that kind of double standard of physical and psychological pain is kind of at the root of what's going on here. You know, I don't know if I was going to necessarily, you know, jump off a roof, you know, 5 minutes, you know,
right.
later, but I had been thinking about suicide since I was a very young kid, and it got much more intense and much more like just, I had no hope, you know, but in the back of my mind, I knew like there's this stuff, it's called heroin, it's going to help me. And right. so I kind of like had this deal with myself that like, you know, let's find this stuff. And if it works, then, you know, then great.
Right.
So,
and it works.
It does. And I think the thing about it is like, you know, we know as, you know, a society, we know that opioids kill pain. You know, that's what they're for. Doctor prescribes opioids. We know that you're hurting. You know, we totally get it, but illicit use, like everything gets kind of flipped on its ear. Like we, I went to rehab, I spent my 19th birthday in rehab, and they told me heroin was the cause of all of my pain. Painkillers cause pain. Depression is an excuse, you know, and it was so backwards to me because, you know, chronic pain is like any, if it lasts, you know, more than 3 months, I think, or maybe it's three, whatever it is, it's like any right. doctor would have considered my pain, you know, chronic if it was physical. So just hearing all that stuff was really, you know, there was no way around it because I couldn't relate to what they were saying. And these guys are the experts. And I had lied about my, you know, I wasn't going around telling anybody that I was on heroin. I hid it for, you know, for 3 years. And so when my mom came to visit, you know, I remember having this conversation with her and my counselor, they had decided that I was in such bad denial that I was liable to drink hand sanitizer if there was any lying around.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And, you know, I was completely honest with them about my use of other drugs and that, you know, I'm fiercely loyal to heroin. And, you know, I mean, opioids at the time, like, you know, I if I had an opportunity to take something else, I would have, but it wasn't like, you know, it is now.
It sounds like a real misunderstanding of yeah. mental health. And you're getting this advice that, you know, you just have to get out of this depression. You're in denial.
No.
And yet you are in immense amount of pain. And yeah. depression is, you know, can be like physical pain. Your body is in pain. And,
yeah.
you know, you're like, this is just an excuse. This is just denial. I mean, that sounds really hopeless to be said that, to be told that.
It was bad. And the thing about it is, you know, it's actually, it was worse than you described because it wasn't just the depression is an excuse. It was the heroin is causing the depression.
Right.
You know? And so in my mind, like I'm sitting there listening to this and I'm thinking like, you know, I mean, I learned in fifth grade that, you know, pot does this and alcohol does that. Like we know that every kind of substance is different, but you know, when drugs are involved and somebody is addicted to drugs, we lump everything together. It's all recreational drugs. There's no, you know, your drug of choice is merely a detail because you're going to chug the hand sanitizer if you get desperate enough and blah, blah, blah. You know, and I explained to my counselor that like, I didn't even think about drinking beer when, you know, like I got
right.
desperate. I mean, so, I mean, come on. So my mom came to visit, or my parents were divorced when I was four. I mean, I'm sure that's, you know, an important part of the story.
Right.
So my father came out first and then my mom was there and I had this conversation with my mother and she was just like, I understand what you're saying. You're making a lot of sense, but what if you're wrong? And,
right.
you know, right. So the 19-year-old version of me back then was just like so incensed that she could say that. And now, you know, I have two kids, you know, no way I'm rolling those dice.
Right. I mean, you could see how as a parent, how scary that would be.
Absolutely. And, you know, at the time, like I knew that my counselor was hadn't graduated from high school, you know, but he's an expert. And I mean, maybe I should have mentioned sooner, but like,
well, I think, you know, I was just looking to say what kind of came to mind as you were talking is I think when we don't understand something or we don't understand it fully, there can be a lot of easy, very black and white thinking.
Yes.
And yeah. We can get lost in that black and white thinking. Right. And, you know, it might make, quote, logical sense somehow, but not really be accurate.
Right. Exactly. And I think that was kind of the thing is that everything that they said made perfect sense in the context that they were saying it. You know, like,
yes,
if addiction was my problem, then of course sobriety is the solution. Like, sobriety is stop taking drugs. So like, if shoveling drugs into my mouth was the problem and I stopped doing that, then, you know, of course that's what you do. So, you know, and all of the like isms and stuff, like I would kind of, you know, I was so cynical. I mean, I've always been very cynical and very pragmatic. And so I was, you know, poking holes in everything. And they were just, you know, they would say like, well, AA works. And how do you, like, there's no angle to drill into that. You know, it works. Well, I say right. It doesn't and you say it does. All right. So, you know, what do we do? So, and the idea that like God was going to solve my, like, it
didn't fit for you. This doesn't make sense to me.
It totally didn't. And it was really, it was infuriating to me because the idea that, you know, like in the 1400s, when you had bubonic plague, you know, you prayed, and if you're a good person, then, you know, God cured you and all like that. So like, if you take that kind of model, like I was dropping any other medical condition on top of it, and it just doesn't work. You know, I mean, like my mom had cancer twice by the time I got to rehab, and
right.
There was no, you know, pray and you'll be fine. So they scared the shit out of
it. It doesn't have the evidence. It's not an evidence-based treatment, I guess.
No, I mean, it's not, you know, and that's the thing. Like I'm very careful to, I never want to discourage anybody from doing anything that works, but at the same time, you know, it's not actually treatment. It's a support group. And that's okay. If that works for you, like, that's totally great. I mean, my mom, you know, she had cancer and chemotherapy with the cancer, and then she joined Gilda's Club, which is, you know, this support group, and it was great. If she would have only done Gilda's Club, I'm sure that she would be dead right now.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing. So, you know, all of the, like, the moral and the shaming and the business, like, that was hard. Because I didn't, you know, I wasn't going around hurting people. I wasn't, like, you know, murdering and robbing people and, you know, whatever. Like, I just wanted to feel okay.
Right. Yeah. And you know, when I look at 12-step groups, you know, I'm a big supporter of 12-step groups because they offer support and community.
Yes.
But I also understand that it, you know, addiction, disease, our physical bodies, our brain, our neurobiology is complex. And we don't understand everything, but having a support community, I think, can be really crucial.
It is
for healing.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, it has its limitations. There's a statement that I kind of try to live by most of the time is, you know, beware the tyranny of the one right way, right?
Right.
There's a lot of options out there, and there's a lot of ways to get sober, and there's a lot of ways to get recovery, or even if sobriety, as they say it, is not your purpose. You have to find what works for you.
Absolutely. I mean, I, you know, and I think the thing with the support groups is that would have been so great for me at any point along the way, but I felt so alienated by AA that, like, you know, that the camaraderie and the accountability, like, that's awesome. And if that works for you, you know, that's totally great. And I think the thing about the treatment piece is, you know, if we know that every type of substance is different, and we know that, you know, like a hit of heroin, the biological mechanics are the same as a hand of blackjack or sleeping with hookers or a shot of tequila or whatever it is. It's like that, you know, high is the same, you know, it's the flood of dopamine and serotonin. Opioids are the only type of substance that have their own, you know, natural target in your brain, your opiate receptors. So they regulate emotion and blah, blah, blah. So there's been all the studies on the neuroplasticity of, you know, what happens in an opioid addict's brain. And for every kind of vice or addiction, like, your neurotransmitters rewire and they seek out the next hit, whatever it is, you know. And so the idea that, like, sobriety gets easier with time, there's a lot of truth to that, because if you stop drinking, if you stop sleeping with hookers, if you stop whatever it is that you're doing, you know, your brain does heal in time and things go back to normal. There have been a lot of studies about opioids that show that doesn't necessarily go back. For some people it does, for some people it doesn't. And the idea, you know, you hear so much like bravado in these conversations about like, oh, nobody was more fucked up than me. You know, I could drink 7,000 beers and, you know, I was shooting 200 bags of dope and whatever. It's not a matter of like, you drank more beer than me. It's just your brain chemistry. So
right.
By that point in your life, it's like, I think there's two things going on. One is the pain that you're experiencing. Like if it seems like if you move it to a physical analogy, it's so much easier for people to understand. Like your foot got chopped off. You're taking morphine that a doctor prescribed. And they go, oh, wait a minute. This is a massive problem. Stop taking the morphine. Your foot's not going to feel better. Like, obviously, right?
Right, right.
So part two of that is the neuroplasticity in your brain. And so now you're feeling just as bad because you have no morphine in your foot, you know, problem. But on top of that, like all of the, you know, not just the emotional well-being, the kind of misfiring between your neurotransmitters, but you have a lower pain threshold, like all of these issues pop up. There's so many latent vulnerabilities that we know about now. And so, you know, I couldn't get on methadone because I was hiding this. You know, I mean, right. Basically, like,
you couldn't talk about it. You couldn't be open about it and have this kind of discussion.
No. Nobody knew. So I got kicked out of rehab for making out with this girl. They sent me to a halfway house, and there was a guy there who I had met in rehab. I was there for about a week, and he was the only other heroin addict that I knew from rehab. I mean, it was, you know, there weren't a lot of heroin addicts back then.
Right. I want before we keep going, I want to go back a little bit and ask one question, because you were in this depression, right? And you found heroin and it helped, right? It fit. It took that depression away.
Pain.
But yeah. When did it start to become problematic for you? When did it start to say, okay, I need to stop this? What was that decision that you made, or how was it showing up in your life that you got to this rehab?
You know, it's interesting because I was so aware at the time and throughout that it wasn't heroin's fault, you know, and I would say this and they'd be like, you're in denial. Like that's addict mentality. But it was the laws and the stigma. If I had a prescription for, you know, like, so the idea of like, you know, you're getting beaten up and arrested and like all of the shit that goes with, you know, being a, you know, a quote unquote junkie, you know, was obviously not good. But, you know, again, if my foot got chopped off and a doctor prescribed morphine and I had refills every month, none of those things would be an issue. But that didn't happen. These were, you know, issues. And that's really what it was. Like I hated the lying. I hated the nonstop risks. I hated not knowing what I was doing. You know, I was always so meticulous,
right.
But you know, you have no idea what you're doing with, you know, I mean, you know, it's powder in a bag. Like who the fuck knows what that is.
Right. You don't know. That's pretty, it can be pretty darn dangerous.
It's very, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I mean, I think, and that's really what's going on, you know, today, that's what's killing people is, you know, you open, you know, a bottle of vodka, you know, exactly, you know, it's 40 proof. It's whatever, you know, a shot is, you know, you can measure it like with, you know, one bag of heroin could be, you know, pulverized vitamins. The next bag is carafentanil. I mean, you know.
So you're looking at this, like, this is working for my depression, but I'm taking these huge amount of risks. Yeah. I'm lying about it. I'm hiding it. This is not worth it. I've got to do something.
Exactly. And so, you know, so at that point, it was just before my 19th birthday. I had tried to stop a few times, but not really. And then the book actually starts. I've got this very close friend, my best friend, who he was the first heroin addict I met. He gave me my first hit and I told him, you know, I'm going to stop. And my mom went to Florida for a week. So I forced myself into this cold turkey, you know, kick. At mom's house, I made my friend Rob take my car and my money and, you know, like to force me into this kind of no exit
right.
situation. And it was brutal. And somewhere in the middle, I still don't remember this, but I ended up calling my father and he came to my mom's house. And I guess I spilled my guts to him. And he brought this friend.
Wow.
This friend of his who was some kind of recovering addict of some sort, and they took me to a detox at a nearby hospital. I was there for a couple of hours and then I left. And, you know, in the meantime, my mom was on her way home from Florida. And, you know, the thing with rehab and all that stuff, like addiction is so reactive, you know, like you look at, like my daughter is a freshman in high school and like we're having college conversations now. We're not talking about what rehab we're going to send her to, you know?
Right.
I mean, hopefully, you know, I'm hoping that doesn't happen, but, you know, it's like addiction is such a like, oh my God, he's on drugs. What do we do? So, you know, so they sent me to this place and it was, you know, they're trained to treat addiction. They're not depression experts. It's not a mental health operation. You know, this is what they do. Mm-hmm. So when my counselor, who is an expert in treating addiction, is told addicts lie, this is addict mentality, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I go in and I, you know, hit every flag or whatever it is. You know, the misunderstanding, like you said, that's like, it felt like it was a Twilight Zone episode, you know, cause I'm going like,
here I am again.
This is insanity. And he's like, no, this all, you know, this is textbook. I mean, they said that to me all the time. You know, this is textbook. So
how did you start getting out of that world? And you started looking at other alternatives to get you some help, to get you some support.
You know, it's funny because I knew about buprenorphine before I started using heroin. There were clinical trials in New York. My friend Rob, the heroin addict, a few of his friends had used it. I thought that it was only for withdrawal. I didn't realize it was a maintenance drug. And of course, I knew about, you know, methadone. But, you know, so right. So
can you tell the audience, if they're listening, they don't know what that is, can you tell them what that is? And so they know what you're talking about.
Sure. So methadone is a full opioid agonist. Basically, there's two medications that are proven to dramatically reduce your risk of death, relapse, and overdose. And that's methadone and buprenorphine. All other forms of treatment or medications do not. And many others actually do the exact opposite. There have been a lot of studies about rehab is actually, and any kind of abstinence-based treatment, whether it's forced or voluntary, increases your risk of overdose because you come out of it, you have no tolerance. You know, that's when people are dying. So I was aware of methadone, but you know, I was in this spot where I couldn't, I got out of rehab and it was like, I was holding my breath. It was like, you know, I know that, you know, my foot is still chopped off. I still don't have the drugs. I still have this lower pain threshold, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so it was like, well, but I can't go back to that stuff because it's going to be a disaster. So I'm going to just... You know, as long as I can
hold your breath, just white knuckle it.
Exactly. And, you know, when, you know, I'll do it when it's an emergency and otherwise, you know, that's that, you know, so that was basically kind of my MO. And I called methadone clinics like every now and again, when I got so desperate, but it was always the same thing. You know, you got to come in there was no way I was going to be able to hide it. And I didn't know that buprenorphine was a maintenance drug. So it was just holding my breath for forever. And I didn't go back to therapy, which I didn't even really think about because, you know, I'd had such bad experiences with antidepressants. And the last therapist that I saw before I went to rehab, it was like maybe a couple of years before, I went into his office. I was trying to figure out what to do about the heroin. I hadn't seen him in about a year. I make an appointment. I go and I sit down and he goes, "You look like a fucking junkie." And I was,
wow.
Yeah. Like, so I started to cry and I left. Because, you know, there's such a
shame.
Yeah, I was ashamed. And there's such a, you know, I think like addiction has been so siloed off away from, you know, medicine for so long that, you know, even with doctors, you know, even today, like I tell a doctor that, you know, I have a history of whatever. And, you know, they assume that like I'm in there looking for drugs.
Right.
You know,
right.
And it's really like you can't get a, you know, fair. You know, I shouldn't say it's not 100%, but it's, you know, I've experienced.
Well, I hope that it's changing. I think it's slowly changing, but it needs a lot more.
It is, but there definitely is that, you know, that kind of, you know, discriminatory. I mean, I don't know how what else to call it. You know?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
So basically it was the holding my breath, white knuckling, you know, and so forth. I went back, I lived in New York City for a while. I moved to Maine. Like I was, you know, the geographic cure, like, you know, whatever I can do. So I met this woman in Maine and I was madly in love and I thought like, she's going to rescue me, you know?
Right.
And everyone in my life at that time, I was like about 23. Everyone believed that I got sober before rehab and that was it. I'm happy. I'm clean. You know, like that's my life. So, you know, of course, I led her to believe this lie. And like, we were together for about a year when I started to have, you know, these, I mean, I think craving is such a, you know, wrong word. We're not talking about ice cream, you know,
right.
It's like breathing. So I started, you know, my pain threshold was, you know, through the roof, and I had to do something about it. You know, so I relapsed, I don't know how many times, but a bunch over the next few years. And I couldn't tell my then girlfriend, who became my fiance and is now my wife, because I was so ashamed. So, you know, I hid it. And so we got married, and we had a baby in 2005. When Ruby, our daughter, was born, I thought, like, I can't do this again. Like, I'm a father. I'm married. I was the breadwinner.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, you can want something as much as you want to, but wanting doesn't make something happen. So like, I wanted to be okay without heroin. I wanted to be sober. I wanted all the stuff. But what I knew from experience was, when I was sober, I had a really hard time functioning. When I was on whatever kind of opioids there were at the time, I got promoted at work. I mean, I built this successful career in private equity. You know, my wife was able to stay at home with our daughter. So Ruby was about a year old, and I fell into this awful hole of depression. And it was just maddening, because I knew what would pull me out of it, but I knew it was going to kill me, you know?
Right.
And so that kind of push-pull was in my head for so long. And I ended up, I relapsed when I had the surgery on, I had a deviated septum, and they gave me a bunch of Percocet. And then after that, I had this, like, I had never had a migraine before in my life. So like, I thought I had this very bad headache, and it turned out that it was like so bad that I had to go to the hospital. Like, there were like cracked vertebrae in my neck. Wow. From the pressure of this thing.
The surgery? Yeah.
No. From the subsequent migraine.
Right.
But, you know, my wife and I were sure it was because of the surgery, but of course the surgeon was like, no, that's crazy. But, you know, the neurologist, you know, they did all these scans, and they were like, this is really bad. And they sent me home with Percocet. And I thought, like, this is totally legit. I'm in physical pain. You know, what am I going to do? Like, this is
right. I'm going to take it.
Yeah. So I took it, and there were a few refills on it. You know, this is in like 2008, back when you could get refills on opioids. And I knew when the line was crossed, you know, like, my head felt fine, mm-hmm. like my neck, like I was physically okay. And, you know, there was that kind of thought of like the double standard, like just anger at the double standard. But at the same time, I knew, like, you know, I'm at a fork in the road.
Right. You could feel like this is not going to be good for me. It's like, I can sense it.
Yeah. Yeah. I exactly. I knew that. So I finished the first bottle of Percocet. I call in the refill. It was like a Saturday, and my wife went to the gym. The drugstore is like a little bit down the road. So Ruby and I, you know, we walk to the drugstore, we pick up the refill, and we're on our way home. And I knew that this was not going to end well. And we get back home, and I brought her up to the bathroom with me, and I opened the Percocet, and I just like was looking at her, and I flushed them.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was really, you know, for a minute, it was like, wow, Superman, you know, like I felt like,
right.
You know, I'm good.
But that in that moment, to understand that, how hard that decision is in that moment.
Yeah, it was. And I think that's kind of the thing, is like, you know, there's so much false hope in the idea of, you know, sobriety is the answer. Drugs are the problem. Mm-hmm. Sobriety is going to solve all your problems. Everything's going to be great. And it's like, that's not actually true at all. Like, that's when things get really
right.
hard. You know, but for 5 minutes, I felt like, you know, everything's fine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So my wife, by the time my wife came home, I was like, you know, thinking about how can I, you know, get into the plumbing, you know, division.
Right. How can I get this? Especially when you're in all that pain.
Yeah. So, so she came home, and she knew that I was like so stressed out. I mean, I was like basically running a company at the time. And so she found a therapist for me, and I go see this therapist, and I started working with him. Anyway, to make a long story short, a couple of months later, he put me on Wellbutrin, and it was like, you know, a little bit of nothing much. And I had heard more about at that point, like a couple of months later, I learned that buprenorphine was a maintenance drug. So this is 2008, you know, long before the opioid crisis, buprenorphine was even less available.
Right. Yeah.
So I found like a list of every buprenorphine doctor in the United States. that was like searchable by zip code or something. So within 100 or 200 miles of my house, there were 6 doctors. So I called all of them, and one by one, they go, we can't treat you. You're not on drugs right now. If you were on drugs, you know, we would be able to do it. And, you know, every conversation was like if I go out and score in order to meet with you, I'm not coming to the appointment. Like, why would I do that?
It makes no sense. Yeah. It's so backwards.
Yeah, exactly. So the last guy, like I got through the first 5, and then I got to the last guy and he said the same thing. And I was just like, listen, I'm going to die. And like, do you want my blood on your hands? Like, I was very, not nasty about it, but just like,
you put the truth out there. I mean, that's the truth.
Exactly. So he agreed to see me. It turned out that his office was like 10 minutes from my office, and he had an opening in like an hour. So I go there and I meet with this guy, and you know, I had no dope in my system at the time, which is very different. You know, usually a buprenorphine induction, you're in some, you know, quasi state of withdrawal. So the fact that I was completely, you know, pure made a huge difference. He gave me 2 milligram, you know, pills, usually a dose, you know, 8 milligrams ish is the, you know, so I took 4 milligrams in his office. They dissolved under my tongue. And by the time I got outside, I made a few wrong turns on the way outside. So it wasn't, you know, like seconds later.
Right.
But, I felt it. And it was the feeling that you get when like withdrawal is setting in and you have a tiny little bit of heroin, you know, that kind of relief that's just like, this is not precisely what I need, but it's going to make it, you know, like
it easier.
Yeah. It's even, you know, it's a snorkel. I can breathe.
Right.
So, you know, so that was, you know, I mean, to say that it saved my life is like a really gross understatement, because of course it saved my life, but it gave me my life, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So you started taking this and tell me how that started to change your life.
I mean, basically, you know, it's like immediately, it changed my life immediately. And, you know, I don't want to say like from fifth grade, but like I was, you know, from the moment I was aware of heroin and I was aware of my depression, it was like, oh, that's going to save me. That's going to save me. You know, so it wasn't like constant distraction, but it was like I was aware of it and I thought about it a lot. And then from when I started using it at 16, it was a full-time job whether I was on it or not. Because either I was thinking about where am I going to get it? How am I going to hide it? How am I going to avoid it? You know, like it was, it took up so much space in my head that there was really not much room for anything else. So getting a legal drug from a drugstore that a doctor prescribed, that there's no, you know, mugging and lying and crap around it, you know, like my life was like, it was like retiring, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I want to get into that part of like the legalization of drugs and all that. But but before we go there,
yeah,
I want to just talk about how, as you did this drug, how it worked for you to shift these cravings or what it was like or how it took that away.
Okay. So, I mean, basically, you know, like, again, the idea that craving is, you know, we're not talking about ice cream here. So it was like, right, you know, your foot chopped off, you're craving morphine, you know, you're drowning underwater, you're craving oxygen. So, you know, it's that kind of craving. And it silenced it immediately. Buprenorphine, it's a partial agonist, so it's less, it basically has kind of like a self-defeating, you know, element to it. I mean, if we know, you know, opioid is a category, so, you know, you've got the whole spectrum of stuff, and then there's buprenorphine all the way off to the side, it's a partial. So it basically, it's like a warm blanket on your opiate receptors that tricks them into thinking they're opiated, which is
right,
exactly what I needed, you know? And so... so I could focus.
Would you say that, because I haven't done heroin and I haven't done this, so I don't know the physical sensation, and that's what I'm trying to understand a little bit. So would it say like you had a sense of like a freedom that came with that? Like you said, it was like a warm blanket.
Yeah.
It took away that drive to seek it and go out and get it and have you know, to.
I think it's like. You know, if you go back to the pain, you know, analogy, I mean, basically like all pain is in your mind, right? Like, you know, the idea that,
right,
oh, it's mental, like, it's, you know, you're not rubbing heroin on your knee like an ice pack, you know, like it's going to your brain. you know, so the craving was like, I'm in pain. This is, you know, excruciating. It's all I can think about. What am I going to do about it? You know, blah, blah, blah. So the buprenorphine staunches the wound, you know?
Right. Yeah.
It's triage. And so, you know, your foot gets chopped off, you're freaking out, and then somebody gives you morphine, buprenorphine, whatever it is that, you know, makes the pain stop. You're okay now. You know,
right.
That's what it is. It's all the same thing. I mean, you know, alcohol is a category. So it's like, you know, if you've had beer, you know what it feels like to drink whiskey. You know,
right.
It's right. The same thing. So like Vicodin is the beer of heroin's, you know, vodka or whatever. You know, so that was it. Like I needed something to staunch the wound so I could heal. And, you know, that's really kind of the thing, is that like if sobriety is I'm not taking drugs anymore, abstinence, and recovery is healing the wounds that led you to drugs in the first place, you know, depression was my gateway to heroin. It wasn't pot and alcohol and whatever.
Right.
So to heal the wounds that led me to the drugs in the first place, I couldn't do that when my foot is, you know, on the side.
Cut off and yeah.
Who can do that? So once, you know, everything was bandaged up and everything was okay, you know, I'm able to focus on it. You know, I can breathe. I mean, like there's so many, you know, analogies that people use. It doesn't make my problems go away. You know, like if I feel like I'm drowning in the middle of the ocean and I'm treading water, you know, all of that kind of business. And, you know, I'm still in the middle of the ocean, but like now I'm in a boat. So like your life is completely different now, you know?
Right. It's like you can breathe, you can do stuff, you can take action besides just going out to try and get the heroin. Yeah. And we can talk about the legality of all that and changing that in our culture. But you could actually function and start to work on your life. It sounds like it gave you that.
It did. I mean, I was singularly focused on not drowning until buprenorphine.
Right.
And so, you know, you're in the middle of the ocean and a you know, rowboat shows up. Your life is completely different now. You know, you're not sitting there going like, oh my God, a shark is going to bite my foot off. How much longer can I tread water for? The sun is giving me a sun. You know, like all of these problems that you have, like it's just, you know, it all just stops immediately. So that was it. But I was still, I hadn't told my wife, like nobody knew. So I was on buprenorphine for 10 years before anybody knew the truth. And that was about like 2-ish, 3 years ago, when I started writing the book. You know, I mean, everything in my life had changed in such a dramatic way. Like I was able to experience joy and contentment, but everything felt so tenuous because I was still living this lie. You know, I mean, like my mom had called a couple of years ago to congratulate me on like 24 years of sobriety. That feels
right.
Bad, you know?
Right.
So, you know, when there was so much misinformation about the opioid crisis and I lost so many friends over, you know, I was just, so much guilt. And I thought like, you know, my silence is really working against the changes that I want to see in the world. It's working against every relationship that I have. Like I've got to just stop this. And I was terrified of, you know, telling my wife, because I wasn't worried about like, you know, oh, heroin is going to be a problem again. Like I was worried about the betrayal. I mean, I actively deceived her for a very long time. We were married for 18, or we'd been together for 18 years when I told her the truth. And she was so gracious about it, so compassionate and understanding.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But it's like, it sounds like this whole journey of growth. One of the things as you're telling your story that I'm seeing and I notice is your drive to find a solution, to keep working on it. And I know it's driven by pain, but it also shows something about who you are. And it's just like this story to keep going and making it better and trusting your own gut.
Yeah.
Trusting yourself.
Yeah. And that's really huge. I mean, like so many people, you know, since I started talking about this out in the world, I mean, you know, my friends, everybody knew that like I had a problem with heroin, you know, way back when. And I would say things like, you know, it's pure evil and, you know, stuff like that.
Right.
And, you know, somebody, I mean, a bunch of people asked me at various points in time, you know, like, well, you must've really had a death wish because that stuff is, you know, whatever. And of course I said yes at the time, but I knew that like, no, I had a life wish if I wanted to
die
like that, you know, and I was so aware at times when I was like, you know, like thinking about killing myself, later in life before the buprenorphine, that, you know, the stigma of addiction is so bad that like, you know, my daughter was like one, and I was seriously contemplating suicide. And I thought like, you know, they'll get sympathy. Like Andrea and Ruby, people will sympathize if I commit suicide, if I kill myself.
If I
go out and I, you know, I'm self-medicating with heroin to avoid killing myself, nobody's going to like that.
I know. It's so backwards. And I think your story, I mean, talking about this and talking about the mental health issues, talking about different ways of treating addiction is so important. And I'm happy that you decided to do that and to put it out there and to let other people see it.
Yeah.
Because this is going to help somebody.
I mean, I really hope so. I mean, you know, like at the, when I started talking about this stuff, I mean, you know, I'm a very shy, quiet, awkward person. I don't like talking about myself. You know, the absolute last thing that I needed was my wife and my mother and everybody in my life knowing all of this terrible stuff and being concerned and, you know, all like that. So, you know, it would have been like, you know, I mean, I couldn't hold it in anymore. And I knew that I wasn't the exception, you know,
right.
There's other people out there that can experience it. I mean, you know, like we know, you know, appearances notwithstanding, like there's no happy, well-adjusted 16-year-old kid who wakes up one day and goes like, you know, I'm really in the mood to break a law. And if I could only get addicted to drugs, like that way I can break laws every day. You know, like that's just
addiction
happens. You know, so, I mean, if you're at a point in your life where you're, you know, sticking needles in your arm, like something's not right, you know,
right.
Addiction is not the problem. You know, addiction is definitely a problem, but like we're self-medicating. Drugs are a form of self-medication. And it's like, you know, I think we as a society get so, you know, wound up about drugs that we kind of like lose our minds in these conversations. Like, you know, there's anything else, any other form of, you know, coping mechanism. We recognize the coping mechanism,
right?
But when drugs are involved, you know, like there's that. I've been using a TV show, Hoarders, for example. You know, I'm not a big TV watcher, but I'm aware of this show, so I'm making generalizations, and hopefully, I'm not wrong. But in the you know few episodes that I've seen, it's always like, oh, Joe is buying all this stuff because his wife died, and he's filling this hole, and you know, his problem isn't an inability to not buy shit at Walmart, you know.
Right.
His problem is his wife died and he's miserable. And everybody sees that and it's so obvious from the minute the show starts. You take that same guy, you stick heroin in his arm, and it's like, oh, the heroin is causing all these problems. You know, his wife probably died for that reason. Like everything gets kind of right. turned on its ear. And of course there are healthier, better ways, you know. I mean, like it's sometimes like it comes out wrong and I don't mean it to. Like I wish that I'd never tried this stuff. I wish I had a better outlet. I'm not telling anybody to go out and, you know, like get some heroin. It's going to solve your problems. Like
right.
the message, you know, but this is what happened. And it's so clear to me that if you're guzzling booze or whatever it is that you're doing, you know, something's not right. And until that is treated, it's white knuckling. It's holding your breath. It's whatever it is. It's like, you know, like recovery doesn't start with abstinence automatically, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I think this is what you're saying is where we have to change how we talk about mental illness and we have to change how we talk about addiction. And we have to look at all the different alternatives to help people thrive. And there's no one right way to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that came out of people wanting to find a solution, but, you know, getting kind of lost in the dogma.
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything else. I mean, I think like, you know, we kind of were stuck to this idea that like there's a universal, you know, modality. And like, why would that be? Like there's nothing right. else that works like this. Why would this one thing, you know, conform to this very precise, totally backwards set of, you know, rules that nothing else works with? Like, it's just, it doesn't make sense. And like, you know, we get so, you know, my parents were so, and rightfully so, scared and angry about the heroin at the time. I wonder in these conversations, like if they would have said, you know, I was too ashamed to tell them why I was using it and they were too angry and scared to ask. But if they would have said, what are you doing this for? What's it doing for you? You know?
Right.
Like things would have been very, very different. And we tend to get so like, you're an asshole for using drugs. You know, this is the problem and whatever it is. Like So I go around for years after that saying, like, oh, you know, it's evil, it's terrible, whatever. I'm invalidating my own issues when I do that.
Yes.
Because if it's pure evil, then it didn't do anything for me. So what am I doing it for? You know?
Right.
But if we say, like, you know, I mean, there's this commercial I saw not too long ago for some rehab that it made me so angry. It's this woman, and she's saying she started drinking when she was like 14, and it was like somebody turned on the lights for the first time. You know, it's what everybody says about everything that they do, right? So it makes perfect sense. So she stopped, and you know, whatever. And then at some point, she said, you know, and then my father died, and I started drinking, and I just couldn't stop. And you know, so I found this rehab, and they told me it's okay, you have an addiction. We're going to deal with it. It's not your fault. So they go through this whole thing, and it's like, her fucking father died. That's the problem. She's really sad. You know, she's not drinking because she's an alcoholic. She's drinking because she's grieving, and she doesn't know what to do with it. You know, so like taking the booze away from her, I'm not saying let her keep drinking, but like, that's not the problem. You put her in a room and you say, lady, no more alcohol for you. That doesn't solve anything for her. How does she cope with the death of her father? How does she deal with this? How does she deal with the underlying depression that was going on before she started drinking when she was 14? Like, you know, just not drinking isn't going to solve your problem.
Right. And in many ways, it's like addiction is the symptom of all of these underlying hurts and pains and suffering. And as human beings, we want out of suffering. I mean, that's just, we're driven to do that. And when we have immense suffering, we'll find a way out sometimes.
Well, we always,
you know,
do. I mean, yeah, we're hardwired for that. And I think, you know, that's definitely the thing. Like we're going to find it.
A way out.
Yeah.
And I think, David, you sharing your story is changing the conversation. And I'm so glad that wherever you found that courage to put it out there, you said you were like, I'm an introvert. What am I doing here on a podcast? And in some ways I'm the same way. Yeah. And so, but I think it's great that you're putting it out there because you're changing the conversation by having it this way. And that there are so many options out there that people need to look at as potential to create the life that is meaningful to them, however that looks. And we're all unique, and that's all different for everybody.
It is. And there shouldn't be a, you know, well, this is what you do and this is what works. I mean, you know, like I know that I can sound like a you know, walking buprenorphine commercial sometimes. And I try to be sensitive to that because, you know, I know that it doesn't work for everybody, and I get that, you know, you don't like it and that guy doesn't like it.
Right.
Like, don't do it, you know, like find something else. But like at the end of the day, like we're putting drugs in our body because something is wrong. Like that's the compulsion. I mean, that's, you know, that's why we do these things. I mean, and for any other condition, you know, you go in with any physical or psychological thing, we identify the source of pain and we treat it so you can heal. With addiction, we like explicitly tell you to ignore the source of pain because it's an excuse and you can't possibly heal. Like it's exactly what you said. We're missing the symptom. You know, I mean, it's like we're treating brain tumors as headaches, and that's, you know, that's a massive problem. So, I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm so happy for anybody who finds anything that works for them, you know, and I think for me, like it was held in for so long. And I spent so much of my life just like second guessing everything I'm saying before I'm saying it and worried about what people think and blah, blah, blah. And I think I just reached a point like a couple of years ago where it was like, I couldn't live with myself keeping all this inside. I felt so just awful about the state of my relationship with my wife that I was, you know, keeping all of this from her and you know, my mom and my brother and, you know, all of my friends and relatives. And it just, it felt so wrong. And I thought, like, you know, if this is useful to anybody, like, that's great. And since that happened, I honestly don't care what people think anymore.
Right.
And it's an amazing feeling.
There's a lot of freedom in that. And even talking with you, I can sense that freedom and relief of not carrying that burden of shame that's projected on anyone who's struggling with mental health or addiction by culture and society and the self, because we all, you know, but to free ourselves from that and to just be ourselves as human beings and figure it out. We'll walk through it together.
Yeah.
There's just a freedom there.
there really is.
Yeah. So I like to ask this question at the end. If someone's listening to this podcast, or, you know, a person who's struggling, or maybe a family member, what would be the one thing you'd want to tell them? What would you want to say to them?
To someone who is struggling right now?
Yeah, right now. They're listening and they're struggling.
I would say to... It's an interesting question. Yeah. I think be honest, but know your audience.
Be honest, but know your audience. I think that's a wise statement.
I mean,
that is wise. Yeah.
You know,
be honest, but know your audience. Yeah. We have to find trustworthy others who we can share ourselves with, who can be compassionate and support us in the changes that we need.
Yeah. I mean, or maybe, you know, find, I mean, I think so many people have parents that don't understand, you know, we have this kind of everything that's, you know, baked into our collective conscious, you know, find somebody who you can talk to.
And there are people out there.
There are. There absolutely are.
Like you.
Yeah, definitely.
So
I'm accepting. So.
Awesome. Thank you, David. How can people find you? Give us a title of your book again, and how can people find you?
Okay. The book is called The Weight of Air. You can find me. My website is davidposes.com. I'm David the Kick on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm not sure what I am on Facebook, but
I'll get all the links. I'll post them in the show notes too. So just go to theaddictedmind.com, and as usual, all the links will be there, and you can contact David if you want to talk to him further or have any questions for him.
Yeah, please.
David, thank you so much for sharing your story and coming on to the Addicted Mind podcast.
Great. Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
All right, everyone, thank you for listening to this episode of the Addicted Mind podcast. You can find all the information about David Posis and his book at theaddictedmind.com/123. Once again, please think about sharing the podcast with a friend. And if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe in iTunes. And think about joining our Facebook group. Just go to Facebook and type in the Addicted Mind podcast and click join. All right, everyone. I hope you have a wonderful day. And I will talk to you on the next episode.
It's easy to blame ourselves for our struggles with alcohol. We see people around us being able to control their drinking without any consequences, yet no matter what we try, we can't seem to figure it out for ourselves. My name is Jillian Teets, and I am the host of the Sober Powered podcast, where I use my biochemistry background to explain the latest research in addiction and help you understand both why you drink the way you do and how to develop the skills and mindset you need to find freedom from alcohol. I discuss topics like why we think about our drinking 24/7, why we have no off switch, and why we crave alcohol. If you're struggling with your drinking or you know someone who is, then I hope that you will check out the Sober Powered podcast. New episodes every Friday. See you there.